There were these two elderly people living in a Florida mobile home park. He was a widower and she was a widow, and they had known one another for a number of years. One evening, there was a community supper in the big activity center. These two were at the same table across from one another. As the meal went on, he made a few admiring glances at her and finally gathered up his courage to ask her, "Will you marry me?" After about 6 seconds of careful consideration, she answered, "Yes, yes, I will." The meal ended with a few more pleasant exchanges, and they went to their respective places. The next morning, he was troubled. Did she say yes, or did she say no? He couldn't remember. Try as he would, he just could not recall, not even a faint memory. With trepidation, he went to the telephone and called her. First, he explained to her that he didn't remember as well as he used to. Then he reviewed the lovely evening past. As he gained a little more courage, he then inquired of her, "When I asked you if you would marry me, did you say yes or did you say no?" He was delighted to hear her say, "Why, I said yes, yes, I will, and I meant it with all my heart." Then she continued, "And I am so glad you called because I couldn't remember who had asked me." That's a good one. Aging and growing older, as most of you know, is not for sissies. But the secret, according to the sages, according to people like Jesus, is not just to grow old, but to take our time to grow up in God, to become wise, as King Lear says, before I am gray. The Hebrew Bible has a collection of books known as the Wisdom Books, which includes the Psalms, the book of Proverbs, which are like little Chinese proverbs, fortune cookies, Song of Songs, and the book of Job's, the book of Job as well as Ecclesiastes. The book of Ecclesiastes, which Maureen just read from, has been attributed to King Solomon, but the word in Hebrew, not Ecclesiastes, but Koheleth, literally means one who addresses an assembly, or the preacher. And it is part of a collection of wisdom books of the Old Testament. But what we can surmise is that it was written by someone who has attained a great age, and throughout that time has struggled to find the meaning of life. And apparently, according to the book, he has chased a lot of rabbits down rabbit holes, only to find a lot of dead ends and a lot of vanity, feeling that most of it is rather pointless. But in the latter years of his life, has concluded that there is much wisdom to be found in being able to hold together the paradoxes of human existence, that there is a time for everything, and to be able to hold and honor the fullness of life, the good and the not so good, the sad and the happy, the hard times and the good times, and trust in the wisdom of God and allow the mystery of eternity to just be, to find meaning and joy in the simplicity, in the beauty of it all. Richard Rohr is a Roman Catholic priest who established and founded the Center for Action and Contemplation. He's written several books that are wonderful, and I know people who have gone to his Center for Spiritual Growth. One of his books that I love the most is entitled Falling Upwards, which is a book that reflects on the two halves of life. He maintains that in the first half of our lives, we are busy with issues of identity and questions of who am I? We are concerned with constructing an image and a sense of self and purpose in the world, with finding security, finding partners to share our lives, establishing careers, making a livelihood, sorting out how to survive in the world. Our questions are all ones around survival. In the second half of our lives, and it depends on when that happens for us, it can happen depending on how difficult our lives have been earlier, or it can happen much later. But usually in the second half of our lives, our thoughts and energy begin to turn toward not survival, but toward the sacred, in which we begin to explore questions of meaning. And there are various movements in what he calls the sacred dance that we undergo through the process of living in order to spiritually deepen and mature. So I'd like to share some of those with you and see how they resonate as truth for your own spiritual journey. He said, any spiritual journey must begin with leaving home. When Jesus says, anyone who must follow me must hate their mother or their father, he's not talking about an actual feeling of hatred or resentment toward one's parents. That would be going against, you know, honor your mother and your father. He's talking about that there is a necessity in growing up about leaving home, of leaving everything that's familiar, leaving all the rules, and developing your own truth and understanding. One of the first steps of the spiritual journey is to leave home, and scriptures are filled with stories of leaving home. The story of Adam and Eve is the archetypal story of leaving the safety and innocence of the garden, where everything is provided, to leave home and to enter into the experience of the wilderness to make their own way, to begin the process of growing up and maturation. I believe the story of Adam and Eve is really our unconscious soul memory of leaving the perfection of heaven to come and enter into the imperfection and struggle of life on earth. For as Jesus said, we come from God and we return to God. We come from heaven and we return to heaven. And in the story of Abraham and Sarah, we're told that God calls them to leave their familiar homeland and to begin the journey to a new country that they have never seen before. So to become the heroes or heroines of our own lives, we first need to leave home, to leave the familiar and set off to test ourselves. The 190 international students who come every year to Oceanside are young souls who have had the courage to leave their own families and cultures and languages to enter into an unknown and unfamiliar world to test their mettle, to see what they're made of, to wrestle with questions of who am I now? Some get homesick and return home quickly. Some learn about how to make friends and have romance. Some learn to be self-disciplined and study, and some make choices to break the rules and get sent home early. I know a few of those. But all of them had the courage to leave home in the first place, to discover who they really are. I know that many of you in this congregation have left what is familiar to try somewhere new. Whether that somewhere new was a country in Africa or other parts of the world, or moved to different parts of Canada, or made a decision to leave family and friends and begin a new life on Vancouver Island. But most of you at different times in your life had the courage to leave home, to discover who you really are. When did you first leave home? How many times have you left home and had the courage to leave the familiar to find out who you really are? And what did you learn about yourself in that leaving? That's part of the second half of life, becoming aware of our leaving home. Another movement in growing up and falling upwards is tragedy of life. Sometime in our lives, whether near the beginning of it, in our family of origin, or sometime later on, we inevitably become aware of the tragedy and frailty, the fragility of human existence. And something occurs that breaks us open, that propels us to question the meaning of this life. It could be an experience of abuse or injustice. It could be a health issue, a hardship. It could be a disappointment or a loss or a grief. But something tragic propels us forward into the deepening of our own souls. It's what Jesus says, that we lose our life in order to find our life, to find our true life, our souls. And so it's important when we come upon these challenges that we do not run from them or avoid them, but that we sit and wait in them, because it is in the painful sufferings of human existence that our souls are forged. I remember when I was going through my first divorce, I went to the doctor and said, I need a leave. I need to sort this out. I need a medical leave. He said, do you want some pills? I said, no. I'm grieving and I'm confused. I don't think you have a pill for that. We have to sit in the painful sufferings of our existence, because it's in the sitting of them and the growing through them that we are grown, that our souls are forged. What tragic happenings in your life have propelled you into questioning the meaning of life and have expanded you, grown you? Another movement, he says, are fallings and necessary sufferings. These are not the sufferings that happen to us. These are the mistakes that we've made, our poor decisions and choices that we've made. It is our fallings that launch us into the richness and depth of our own souls. It is when the false self that we have so carefully constructed falls apart that the very important work of the soul begins, moving from our false self to our true self. This falling can come about by a deliberate breaking of the rules of our own self-imposed or societal taboos and norms. It could be a breaking of the law or the breaking of a moral law, a time when you failed and your weaknesses were exposed. Whatever falling you have endured that results in a humiliation that cuts deep into the core of who you thought you were, this is wonderful grist for the soul mill. Perhaps you failed a course, or failed a job, or been caught in a lie, or wrestled with addiction, or endured the breakup of a relationship, or faced public humiliation, or faced your own demons and shadows in whatever scenario they emerged from your psyche. This, Richard Rohr tells us, is the stuff of what the soul journey is made of. It is these humiliations that help to shatter the ego and launch us into the truth of our real and authentic selves, our soul essence. What humiliations have you suffered? And how have these humiliations deepened and strengthened and grown you in unimaginable ways? These humiliations remind us that it is through these humiliations that we grow in our understanding, our wisdom, our compassion. And these all emerge as gifts within the soul. We need to give God thanks for these humiliations, because from them the soul expands and grows more visible. Ironically, says Richard Rohr, it is in our fallings that we begin to move upward, Godward. And then he talks about shadow boxing. He says it's important when we undergo humiliations that we do not blame others for our mistakes or choices, but take responsibility for them and face our own shadows and demons. The shadow, he says, are those parts of ourselves, those very human parts in us that we like to reject, that we cannot accept about ourselves, our jealousies and envies, our compulsions, our angers and resentments, our weaknesses, our lust for power or control, our subtle needs for praise or approval, our pride and vanities, our hidden motivations and behaviors. He invites us to get to know our shadow self. He invites us to find someone we trust that loves us both conditionally and unconditionally, enough to be honest with us about the shadow parts of ourselves that we don't want to see or face. When I was working on this sermon, I turned to Ray and I said, "Tell me about my shadow self." She gladly did so. And then she asked about hers. It was wonderful. It was very liberating. It's wonderful when someone knows us better than we know ourselves, so that we can use that to grow. As we move with more awareness into the second half of our lives, we can begin to see the tragedies, the sufferings, the shadows, all as gift, as part of the whole of life that is there to grow our souls. Like Koheleth, we begin to see the goodness of life amid the paradoxes, the time for birthing and the time for dying, the time for laughing and the time for mourning, the time for killing and the time for healing. And we've come to make peace with the tragedies, the sufferings, our shadows, as part of the totality of the human experience. Because then we can go shadow dancing, he says. In the second half of life, he says, we learn to take the tragedies in stride, not to run from our humiliations and shadows and try to hide from them, but to kind of come to expect them, not to be surprised by them when they pop up unbidden, to see them. We know that we have entered the wiser years of the second half when we come upon a difficulty, a grief, a challenge, and wonder, how can I use this new experience as an opportunity to grow my soul? In the wiser years of our life, we can begin to laugh at our own shadows. Our demons no longer frighten or shame us. We're more amused by their persistence in us than anything. We learn to laugh at ourselves and refuse to be controlled by them. And sometimes we can even use their gift and use them for purposes of teaching and mentoring another. How are you learning to dance and play with your shadow? enjoying simplicity. In the second half of life, we begin to enjoy the wonder of the little things, to become aware and notice the birds building their nests outside our window, and hear the laughter of the children playing in the schoolyard, and spend time just enjoying the simplicity of that. Recognizing and becoming aware of the miracle of the touch of a hand and the dance of a wrinkled aging hand, or the outstretched hand of a person living on the street. In the latter years, the busyness begins to wind down and we begin to see wonder and beauty and pathos everywhere we turn. In the latter years, like the small, unhurried child, we begin to stop to notice the things we would have rushed by years earlier. Jesus reminds us that it is in learning to see the world in a new way that the kingdom of God actually appears. That it is in seeing the world with the eyes of a child that the kingdom of God comes to fruition. Planting a small seed with hope, having faith the size of a mustard seed, being the little salt and the little light, we recognize in the latter years that it is the little things that are the most important. What are the simple things in your life that are touching your soul right now? Generativity. Unlike the first half of life when we were consumed by collecting and accumulating things to build ourselves up and create a sense of identity, now in the latter half of our life, we desire to let go, to give away things, not to serve ourselves, but to serve others, to give away ourselves, to give to those who come after us. We learn to care more about how the other is doing than how we are doing. We seek to find ways to contribute, to make a difference. Now we begin to notice that all the complex questions boil down to one simple act, the act of extending ourselves in love. That is the meaning of existence, and that is enough, as Kohelis says, to enjoy all our work. Toil becomes something to be enjoyed, not a means to an end. A couple of days ago, I called two women who have come new to our church, who have touched my heart. And I asked them to speak today in the moment of sharing, but one I discovered was having surgery, so couldn't do it. So we postponed their moment of sharing for another time. But I wanted to tell you about them still. Jeanette Mossing and Mert Omnis. Even in their mid-80s, they have entered into the life of this church, taking every course, every Bible study, every course they can, singing in the choir, continually exposing themselves to new thoughts and new ideas, serving others, giving generously to the women's retreat so that others can go when they themselves couldn't, and doing it secretly, giving themselves away at the gathering place, serving at the seniors' connection. One of the women just went into hospital, Jeanette, for shoulder surgery. And when I went to visit her yesterday, she was there in the hospital after surgery, bright and shining as ever, speaking kindly to the nurses, laughing at herself, radiant, and looking forward to coming back to the church to serve again at the gathering place. And lying in her hospital bed post-surgery, she said to me, "Jennifer, I figured out that when all is said and done, life comes down to this. Love God and love your neighbor as yourself. That's the whole thing." I said, "I think you're right. That's the whole thing." In the latter half of life, we learn to focus and give to what is most important, loving others and passing on our love and wisdom to the next generation. And finally, in the second half of life, We have endured enough losses and griefs and tragedies that we have learned to surrender to the mystery of it all. And we have learned to trust the unfolding of life. We begin to let go into the mystery of existence and trust that all manner of things, as Julian of Norwich, the great mystic, said, shall be well again. That we will indeed endure, which means to grow strong. As Paul says, suffering produces endurance, endurance produces character, and character produces hope, and hope does not disappoint. In the second half of life, we recognize that there isn't an answer for every question, and we can live with the uncertainty of things and not need to fix every problem because we know we can't. We become aware that it is important that we vote and we contribute, but we cannot control who gets into power and who is at the helm of things. All we can do is pray and hope for the Spirit to move and shift, that things will happen, and in our part of the world, we can bring healing and little miracles can happen along the way. All we can do is stand with integrity with someone who is also asking the sacred question, why? As Kohelis says, God has put eternity into our minds, yet we cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. But it's all beautiful in its own time. And I know this, he says, whatever God does endures forever. And so if we have been intentional about our spiritual journey, in the latter years, we trust that we cannot understand all the hows and whys of everything, the mystery that is life. But we can trust that out of all of our endings, that there are always new beginnings, that there is an eternity. And so we can trust the sacred dance of life and learn to enjoy the time, all of the time for mourning and the time for dancing, the time for embracing and the time for refrain from embracing, the time for war and the time for peace, that we can enter into the experience, the fullness of human existence, and learn to enjoy every moment of it all. For this is the work of our soul. At the end of the very dark movie American Beauty, the main character, who has made some serious mistakes in his life, mistakes with his wife, with his daughter, with his neighbor, at the end of his life, when he is looking at a picture of his family and having this wonderful smile, he is suddenly, unexpectedly shot in the back of his head by an angry neighbor. And he dies, and his spirit is floating upward. And we hear his voice, and he is seeing all of his life flash before him, all the myriad of moments that have made up his life. He sees and remembers again the smell of the hay as he lies in a field, a young teen looking up at the stars in the sky and imagining the mystery of life and just wondering. He sees again the image of his daughter when she was a little girl dressed in a princess costume and waving a sparkler. He sees again the image of his wife in her younger years with her head thrown back, laughing and holding on to a roller coaster ride. And he sees an ordinary white bag being tossed around by gusts of wind in a grace-filled dance. And his soul notices as he is moving upward that in his falling, in his tragic, unexpected dying, he notices that even in the ugliness and ordinariness of life, it is all beautiful in its own time. And he reminds us that someday we too will realize the extraordinary beauty of our ordinary life. That's the work of our soul. May it be so. Amen.